It went quiet. Is it muted? Yes. Can everybody hear me? Okay, yes. Okay, good. I am talking to a silent VC screen, so it's a little bit weird. Sorry. But I can see you, so this is an improvement over the last time I tried a video conference out of the White House. Have anybody... It looks like there's, I don't know, 100 or so people here. Have any of you already seen me do this talk or something like it before? Oh, I could hear for a second. Okay, so it looks like a handful of people, you know, 10 or 15 or so. It's not important, I don't care. I just didn't want to repeat myself, everybody's already heard it. I thought I would just tell you briefly a little bit about my story, and then we're going to try to do time for some questions. I am sorry I'm not there in person, first of all. I meant to be. I tried to be as late as last week, and then I ended up canceling very late because that healthcare.gov website that you heard or mentioned a minute ago, the open enrollment period opens again on Saturday. And it was just not a time that I could afford to lose the time on airplanes to go back and forth both times. So I couldn't make it. I hope I can make it next year, unless the conference is right before the beginning of open enrollment again, which it might be, in which case I'll have the same problem again. So anyway, thanks for that introduction. My name is Mikey. A little over a year ago at this time, I was minding my own business working at Google, where I managed a part of the site reliability engineering department. And I will bet that my screen isn't big enough for me to tell, but I will bet that some of those people who raised their hand a minute ago and said they have heard me talk about this before, I'll bet there are some people there who used to work for me. Is there anybody here who used to work for me? Damn, really? Oh well, I guess they have already heard this, so they didn't hear it again, I guess. So a year ago, I was, like I said, minding my own business. I got called and asked to be part of what at the time was considered the tech surge, is what they called it, which was the group of, it was originally just five or six people that they had go to do, to try and work on healthcare.gov in the first place, trying to figure out what's wrong with it. It started weird and got weirder. From calling in on the phone to the original first day when they were introducing us to a bunch of people who turned out to be like the cabinet secretaries and the administrators, the leaders of these federal agencies, with me like typing in the names as we're going along in order to look up who they are on Wikipedia, because I did not know. I was on the other end of a phone call at this time because I couldn't fly out there fast enough to be there for the first meetings. We went from that to Todd telling people that we were going to work on healthcare.gov and it was all going to be okay, to me flying out to Washington, D.C. for 3 days. That 3 days turned into 3 weeks. The 3 weeks turned into 3 months, and around January, so I was there on leave of absence from my regular job from October to January. I went home January 6th, and then the site was working a lot better, as has been reported in a lot of places. There's been some articles. For reasons that I could talk about at a long length, but basically for the way that the media and PR reporting machine works, the story fell out in a way that people gave me and the Tech Surge group a ton of credit for turning the site around, and certainly we worked very hard, harder than I have on anything else ever or ever hope to again. We were contractors in those months, and I had to submit hourly invoices, and the one that I submitted for December 31st that covered the previous 9 week period had a mean number of hours billed of 17 and a half, 7 days a week for the period leading up to that, which means that there were, for every day I had that was only 12 hours long, I had another day which was 20 something hours long, and it was extremely exhausting, and I could not physically do it for much longer than we did, which is why I went home in January. We found other people to pick it up, put together a group of people, followed out the end of the open enrollment period. And then, like I was starting to say, whatever reason, the press story being what it was, gave us and me personally a lot of credit for fixing the site. We started to be in the news. We were on the cover of Time magazine. so on and so forth, got a ton of attention for, which was a very surreal experience because nothing we did to fix the website actually seemed like it was hard in any kind of technical sense. It was just a lot of people that needed to be a little bit better organized in order to get the project actually, you know, put together and out the door. So I went back in January, went back to minding my own business, went back to my job, tried very hard to care about the stuff that I was doing there, which was not terribly easy, having just come back from healthcare.gov, where literally millions of people's lives were affected by being able to get enrolled for health insurance, many of them for the first time, because it was the first chance for people that had been disqualified because of a pre-existing medical condition, something like that. People who needed healthcare the most and were not able to buy it on the private market had just been able to. Todd Park, who was the CTO of the United States at the time, who we worked with very closely, he would read to us letters that had been written to the president that he would get a hold of, the text of, frequently the operations staff, which are generally a fairly hard-boiled group, as you're well aware. This is, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people who would fit right in this audience right here today. There would be tears at the reading of the letters because a lot of them were literally, something along the lines of, you know, dear Mr. President, I am writing to you from my hospital bed where I just got the lung transplant, which without which I would have died 2 weeks ago. So thanks for fixing that website. Times thousands and thousands of people. We came. Oh, good. I can hear when people laugh at least. I came home from that, went back to my job, which I will caricature at the moment as being trying to find ways to make our ad serving a couple of percent more efficient so that one billionaire can make a few extra $100 million as opposed to a different billionaire making that few $100 million. And I found it very hard to get super enthusiastic about doing that again. I gave it my best shot, but I was a very weak target when the White House came back around in about May of last year and started aggressively recruiting, asking me to consider come back and do this job. Which they now call U.S. Digital Service. And U.S. Digital Service got created. It was well in motion before us jokers showed up last fall. But the whole healthcare.gov launch, near failure, injection of a small number of people, turnaround, then successful operation. That whole story was kind of tailor-made to give a big shot in the arm to the people that were trying to launch something like U.S. Digital Service already. It really demonstrated that actually it is possible for government websites to not completely suck. They can work sometimes. Adding the people that have the skills in building and maintaining these kinds of services makes a big difference. So that was basically the sales pitch for U.S. Digital Service. When the healthcare.gov thing came around, the whole process got, like I said, it was a big accelerant on getting that off the ground. When they talked about actually having all the pieces in place and being ready to actually launch last July, August, it took a few months, but I was eventually persuaded to come to the job. I quit. Google left behind my unvested stock and all those things, which were mildly painful, as I'm sure a lot of you can relate to, and moved out here and started here August 11th. So we have been in business since August 11th as the thing called the U.S. Digital Service. Today, we are 24 people. That was the first concern I had before I agreed to do this job, was I thought recruiting would be incredibly hard, because who wants to go work for the government? It doesn't have a reputation of being a lot of fun. Now that I'm here, I can tell you it has earned that reputation in a lot of ways. But there are other things about it that are really appealing to people, and people really do respond to the idea of being able to do public service, which is actually a thing that our profession needs to, it's an idea that needs to, that we need to start thinking about as the people that build websites, that build technology, that maintain, you know, what at Google were called SREs, what other groups call DevOps. I'm talking here about the people that have learned, usually by trial and error, trial by fire, how to run large distributed services to high uptime demands that interface with the general public, do high volume transactions, and are actually reliable and useful enough that people come to depend on them in their day-to-day life, which is Google, Facebook, Amazon, all of these sites match that description. Building and running things like that is a fairly new profession, but it's one that the government now can't do without. So, the government has to get better at this. We represent the effort to try to make them better at this. Like I said, I was terrified about not being able to recruit any good people. I did not have that problem at all. The fact that we're 24 people today is honestly faster than I was able to attract anybody to even what I thought were fairly attractive teams when it was my job to construct a new team when I was working inside Google. We have missions that people want that you can't get anywhere else. I think we'll be able to talk about those in the questions and answers a little bit in a minute here. There's been a ton of interested people. We're doing great there. The next thing I worried about was that our agencies, the customers that we work with inside the White House. So basically, the federal government is like this fantastically complicated bureaucracy, which is a federation of a whole lot of smaller bureaucracies, which are all the different agencies that do different things. And that's, you know what agencies are. They're like Department of Transportation or like EPA or blah, 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 blah. Most agencies have a bunch of sub-agencies. The sub-agencies have bureaus and field offices. It's incredibly complicated. And it's not the easiest thing to get the attention of the like whole big spread out bureaucracy and get them to actually do things in a new way. I thought that would be also a very difficult problem. It so happens that we have the opposite problem. We have way more demand for our help, for our services, than we could ever hope to satisfy. Both of those problems, for what it's worth, both of those things that I thought would be problems are actually turning out to go pretty well, being the recruiting of people from the outside and the ability to find customers that are interested in what we have to offer. We're doing a lot of our success at both of those fronts. By the way, the credit goes directly to President Obama, who personally helps us recruit people and talks about what we have to offer to the cabinet agencies regularly and tells them. We have become, this is a little bit of a terrifying thing, honestly, but we have become the thing that the president brings up anytime anybody tells him about a technology problem of some kind. He literally has been known to say, what does U.S. Digital Service think about that? What does Mikey think about that? Which, if you can imagine showing up in Washington, D.C. Under this banner and saying, we're here to fix all of your computer problems, we're really good at this computer stuff, let us help. If you can imagine like the flood of requests that you get, which are just really hard to prioritize, by the way, because every agency up in here is doing something that that affects millions of people. We can't do them all. We can't do all the projects. We can only do a few. So the prioritization has been difficult, but the demand we have not had any trouble like finding demand for our services. That kind of brings us to where we are today. Like I said, we're 24 people. We have a headquarters, which I wish we could have done this from, but it's a place called Jackson Place. It's just outside the fence of the White House compound over here. There's a row of buildings that are also owned by the White House, basically, which are where our offices, our main headquarters is. That's actually very convenient real estate, much in demand, because we can have meetings and bring people from the outside without having to go through the Secret Service, so that's handy. I have an office that I use most of the day up in what's called the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, which is just over that way, which is inside the White House compound. I spend a lot of time in the West Wing. My day starts literally every day now. My day starts at 8:30 a.m. In the Roosevelt Room, which is the President's Conference Room. It's just outside the Oval Office with what's called the Senior Staff Meeting, where you hear about some topic of interest. They're incredibly varied, as you can imagine, the entire business, the entire federal government. People talk about other things that are interest. They basically, the President's senior staff basically have a stand-up meeting every day, which is, where I have to start. Have a lot of other meetings frequently in the West Wing all day long. We, people on our staff, on U.S. Digital Service staff, all of the doors are open, as best as I can tell. We have a seat at the table for even policy-like decisions. I am happy, not that I can take credit for this personally, but I am certainly happy at the stance that the administration came out with a few days ago on net neutrality. I hope that that's a popular position with you guys. At least I would think that it would be. I was super happy to see that come out. That's the kind of thing that we do in a couple hours work at this job. And we work, we're working very hard, I probably am around 80 to 100 hours a week, and I know most of the staff are too. But that's the kind of thing we do here. And it's really overwhelming to try and express, sometimes put into words, like what the potential is for impact. So things are going pretty well for us, is basically what I have to report today. And I think that's enough undirected rambling from me for the moment, and now I am ready to answer some questions, which I think Amy is going to moderate, if I remember.
That is correct. So I know that people are probably excited to get up and ask questions directly, but in the interest of time, and we know there's a deadline close, we're trying to come up with some preordained questions for Mikey so he can go through those. So I think a big question that's on everybody's mind at this point, with the deadline Saturday, you've had some more time to improve the website for the healthcare. What are your technical concerns now, and sort of what things have you done to shore things up to make them so that they're more resilient?
Sure. So let's see. I can't say it enough times. The press never reports it this way, but I keep saying it anyway. Almost all of the work to improve healthcare.gov is being done by the agency, which CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who owns this project, and the contractors that work on it, which are a bunch of commercial companies that are, that they're all. All of them have pulled out all the stops. They do most of the work here. I remember I went home last January. I was only kind of peripherally involved through the end of the open enrollment period in March, and then I was not at all involved until August when I came back here. So they have carried the ball on this. What's been going on is it's been kind of a I am pretty happy with how that development process has been going. It's been a process of continuous improvement in small increments. There was obviously an impulse after last October when you saw how that went. There was a strong impulse to kind of junk this whole thing and write a new one from scratch, which I and the other people that we brought as a tech surge kind of argued against, because as tempting as that is, first of all, when would it ever launch? Second of all, all the classical second system syndrome stuff, if you know you're like a mythical man month, there's not much reason to think that that writing it over again from scratch would have been successful. At least we didn't think so. So it's been kind of a schedule of weekly releases, monthly releases. The software has gotten a little bit better over time. So people that we brought in, kind of some of the new talent that we brought to the table during the tech surge last year, hung around and got involved in a kind of a more long-term fashion. They are responsible for a couple of features that I'm pretty proud of on healthcare.gov today, which are the what they're calling window shopping. The press calls window shopping. The team hates that name because they think that it makes it sound easier than it actually is. You still have to submit a little bit of information to see rates and so on. But the anonymous shopping tool that lets you see what plans are available and what the prices are going to be without going through the entire heavyweight application, that's a tool that that we launched a week or so ago and is doing pretty well. The streamlined application process, which the press has written about it a few times, but doesn't have a real good name to pin down. Sometimes it's called the Marketplace Lite. Sometimes it's called Marketplace 2.0. Anyway, the point is there's a simplified version of the application that a large number of people can go through if they meet certain criteria, if they're a relatively simple case. That's another part that we delivered that we're super happy with, is working relatively well so far. You asked what concerns we have. Well, I mean, we are up against there are a couple of legitimate engineering challenges that make this harder than when you're launching some random thing as a startup. One of them is that we don't get to do we have a Big Bang launch, which is like written into legislation that says November 15th is when the site will go live and everybody will be allowed to shop for insurance at the same time. That's a big launch date, and I'm anxious as any of you would be 2 days before a big launch date. Like, at this point, we have dotted every I and crossed every T as best as we can figure out how. There's been a ton of load testing, a lot of performance testing on the various components, but we won't really know how it performs under load until we see how it performs under real load on Saturday, Sunday, Monday. We'll see. So I kind of have kind of this generalized anxiety level. Like I said, I'm sure that many of you have launched products before and have experienced this, but I don't have anything specific that I'm super worried about. Like, we'll see when we get there. One thing that I'm confident in, I already said, like, I have a lot of reasons to think that this is going to go a lot better than it did last year, and I do believe with good confidence that it's going to go a lot better than it did last year. The other thing I'm sure of is, if you look at where we started from in October and how bad things were, if you look at that and look at how we started late, like, it was just me and like the five other people didn't really hit the ground until 3 weeks after the launch date, when it had been, you know, on TV as a huge flaming disaster for 3 weeks. That's when we got involved last year. And we still managed to kind of patch things up enough and hold it together with a lot of brute force work to get through the open enrollment period to get 8 million people enrolled last year. If we could do that last year, a lot of those same people are ready to jump in again if it should become necessary. And we have a supply of other people who are willing to make the same sacrifices we did to work on healthcare.gov if it should become necessary. So, even worst case scenario, if all of our preparations don't play out the way we want them to, kind of the firefighting crew is as ready as it was a year ago to get involved again, and I have a lot of confidence that we'll be able to pull something out. The only variable is how much of it is going to be brute force and firefighting, and how much of it is just going to go according to plan. Obviously, I hope it mostly goes according to plan. We'll see.
Great, thank you. The next question was, what types of high-priority projects fall under the purview of the U.S. Digital Service? You mentioned there are quite a few, and how do you prioritize them?
That's a good question. I get that question a lot, both from in public events like this and from Congress and from other people in the administration. So we have we're 24 people. We have a handful of significant size projects, not more than that. Some of them I'm able to talk about right now today. Some others I'm not able to talk about now, and I hope to very soon in the future. And then there's some that we'll probably never be able to talk about. But what I can talk about right now today is healthcare.gov. Obviously, you already know about that one. That's a pretty intense effort. We've got a handful of people working up there at the operations center right now. I wish they were here and I could introduce them to you, and you could say thank you for being American heroes and taking time off their job and so on and so forth. But you'll have to take my word for it, say that they exist and they're up there doing their work. So healthcare.gov, we're also deeply involved with the VA. If you follow the news, you might have read once or twice that the VA is struggling here and there with a couple of operational challenges. We're working with them to build their own digital service team, which will look much like the one we have right here in the White House. We've worked with them on the hiring process. We've helped with the process of finding talent. We're partnered with them on several internal kind of technology projects that will affect the veteran experience directly. So this gets to your third question, which is how do we prioritize them? What we care about, what we're specifically here for, is kind of customer-facing, citizen-facing services. There are absolutely agencies that where what they need is like a newer, more modern, email system, and maybe the printers don't work real well, and like that's a real problem, and somebody should address that. But like we don't get super excited about that kind of stuff. We're specifically here to do the things that that we have specific expertise in, which is building customer-facing, large-scale systems that people depend on. Now, we're willing to stretch the definition of customer-facing a fair bit, such as, take the VA, for example. They have to process disability claims, and they use all these systems for processing those disability claims. And those may not be customer-facing exactly, like they're not online for you to, like, view your own claim, but they are customer-facing in the sense of the veterans don't get their benefits until this process is completed, so they have a stake. It's very important to accomplishing the agency's actual mission that these work well. That's the kind of stuff that we're interested in looking for. We look for the biggest citizen impact. We evaluate how much money is at stake, as in how much would we, the taxpayers, lose if this project was unsuccessful. That's a factor that we look at. And we look at the agencies, we have a little scoring system, and we also have a factor for how tractable the problem appears to be. Now, an important feature of U.S. Digital Service that I love to talk about is there is no such thing as a project that's so far gone as it's too hard that we refuse to take it on because we think it's a lost cause. Like, if it's important, if it's something that like people depend on, such as healthcare.gov, if it's something like the veterans claim system, if it's something that actually is going to be of life-changing importance to a significant number of people, then we'll take it on, even if it looks intractable, because that was a serious problem with healthcare.gov that helped it. That is part of the reason why it got it to the state it got itself into when it was in bad shape a year ago. There were other parties that had the expertise to work on this kind of problem who just didn't want to get involved because it looked like too much of a mess. And it was too hard, and they might end up getting blamed for it, and it was a political mess, and it was very sensitive, and a whole lot of good reasons why, if you were a company, you might not want to get your fingerprints on this. But that left this gap, which is that you need to have somebody somewhere who goes to where the need is, instead of staying away because it looks too hard. So with that disclaimer, being that you can't possibly create a project which is so bad that it totally disqualifies us from working on it because that's our role. Now, that being said, in our little prioritization system, we're not dumb. We do try to direct resources to where we're going to get good bang for the buck with the limited resources that we have. So we look for places where the readiness to accept change is high.
Great, thanks.
I think I sort of answered your question.
I think you pretty much answered it. So you mentioned, thanks. That you picked up, you moved to the White House, you left Google behind. Not everyone can do that, and not everyone wants to. So what can we do as sysadmins, programmers, software developers, in our spare time to help out with these kind of problems?
So if you are interested at all by what you're hearing me talk about, and there is any level of commitment that you're ready to make, as you say, not everybody... I understand it's not that not every single person in the room is going to get up and file out into the hall and cancel their lease in order to move to Washington, D.C. and work on this stuff. If you want to, great. If you can do something less than that, then there are probably still valuable things you can do. We, a lot of our staff, the 24 people that I mentioned a minute ago, a good number of those are what we have taken to calling the digital reserves, meaning they're not full-time permanent government employees. They're typically on a leave of absence from their regular brand job back in Silicon Valley or Seattle or Chicago or New York or Atlanta or wherever it is. A lot of companies will have already got leave of absence policies that will enable you to do this now, such as, well, it is probably best for me not to talk about anybody by name, but I've already told you that I went on leave of absence from my previous fancy pants job in order to do this, so it was a thing that was possible to do. A lot of companies will let you do this if you ask. They tend not to advertise it a ton. They don't talk about it a lot, which is why I'm up here talking about it right now. In a lot of cases, you could take anywhere from 2 weeks to a few months as a leave of absence. You could come out here, you could work for us, you can be hired by us. You'll be treated exactly the same as anybody else and part of the extended team for the limited time that you're able to be here. Now, if you can't be here full-time at all, we still have stuff that can be done remotely. It's not probably going to be like really in the thick of things at an agency engagement, because it's very hands-on, high-touch process. It's basically a kind of project management, like what Google called project manager, is kind of the role that we find ourselves in a lot of the time. As you can well imagine, that doesn't go super well when your only introduction to everybody is by email. But we have other things. There are other ways people can contribute. We need a lot of help with our hiring process. We want to accept applications from as many people as we can and give them all as fair a hearing as we possibly can, obviously. But that's an incredibly labor-intensive process, screening them, phone screening them, interviewing them, doing resume screening, stuff like that. That's a thing we could use a lot of help with. There are a couple or one or two other ideas of things that you can do remotely. So there are opportunities to do this kind of stuff. It's obviously the more of a commitment you can make, the more of an impact you can have. So expect us to use this technique of commitment escalation. I will warn you now, because we will never warn you of this again, just like nobody warned me. If we ask you, if you say you're maybe interested to come out for a few days and take a look around, we'll say, great, fantastic. When you get here and take a look around, if you're good at all, like if you turn out to completely suck, then there's a different decision path that we go down. But that hasn't really been a concern so far. If you're good, then before you go home for those 3 days, we're going to say, you know, you've really done some good here. You know, what would be really great would be if you could spend a few weeks here. If you tell us that you can spend a few weeks here, same thing's going to happen. We're going to say, you know, what would be even better would be if you could stay for a few months. If you come for a few months, then we're going to say, you know, it would just be like super peachy keen would be if you could stay for a couple years. So that will happen. But we do have people that have made good contributions and good impact at every level of commitment.
It's good to know that the slippery slope of competence is everywhere. One of the things that you talk about is trying to work with all these different companies and sort of enforce best practices and get them to talk to each other. You know, how do you do that?
So
everybody in the audience was like, yeah.
Well, it helps that a huge amount of the like best practices that we advocate for are really basic stuff, like super common sense. Like we released, so when Digital Service was created August 11th, on that date they released two documents. One of them was called the Digital Services Playbook and the other was called the Tech FAR. I don't know what questions are coming up here. If you ask me a ton about federal procurement, then I'm ready to talk about the Tech FAR, but let's assume for the moment that you're not going to ask about that. The Digital Service Playbook can be summarized in one page. It's just like 12 or 13 things, and they're really simple things, which are like, this is basically our recipe for like, if you want your project to succeed, then we suggest you do it the following way, which is a lot of them down to do some kind of modern-ish development practice, like anything that resembles any kind of agile process where you actually do things in small pieces and then readjust your plans depending on how those small pieces go. Like, that's really all we're looking for. Because the government still loves to do this giant waterfall, like you do an RFP, and the RFP takes 18 months, then soliciting bids takes 6 months, then we do a brief, then we do like a requirements definition process, which takes another 6 months, and at the end of that, we give you a project plan, which we sit back and think that, like, okay, so 3 years from now, we'll have a working website. Like, that's how these contracts are written sometimes. It doesn't have a high rate of success. That development methodology, you know, classical old-timey waterfall, doesn't have a high rate of success anywhere in the private sector either. That's why these newer systems got really popular. So the point I'm making is we are usually asking people for things that they already know are the right thing to do. And a lot of times all we have to actually do is kind of give them permission to do the right thing because there's a huge amount of inertia and a huge amount of fear. Like every company has this. My old company had this to a certain extent. The government has it as well, where people are afraid to do something different from the way they've done it before because it might go bad. And hilariously, the way people's brains work, they still perceive it as less risk to them to do the same thing we did last time, even when it failed last time, even when it failed for the last 20 times in a row. That's still the safe option, even though you're like practically guaranteeing that we're going to fail. But to the individual, that looks like a rational choice. So like, a lot of times all it takes is we kind of, like I said, give them permission to try something new and say, look, we're the U.S. Digital Service. Here we are. We have this flag. We have the, not literally, but we have this metaphorical flag that we ride into town with. We hand out copies of the, you know, Digital Services playbook, you know, and all the townspeople line up and throw roses in front of us, as you'd expect when you show up at a government agency. We say, look, there's a new way to do stuff, and kind of the subtext here is if it doesn't go well, then you can blame us. And we don't, that's not like part of the like sales pitch, but that's kind of the subtext, and that goes a long way. Like if they just have somebody else kind of looking over their shoulder that they have confidence is going to be there to help them pick up the pieces if something goes horribly wrong. If we try really, really hard. This is another one of those common sense things that we bring with us. We try really, really hard to de-escalate the whole like blame-shifting culture that goes on here sometimes. And again, this is not unique to government. Like any big software project that has multiple components and multiple teams working on different deadlines that depend on each other, you've all seen this happen. When you start looking for ways to throw other components project under the bus, we try really hard to de-escalate that and say this is not helpful. We're not here. We are USDS is not here to pick winners and losers in this like long brewing like knife fight that you've got going on amongst yourselves. We don't care. We just want the ultimate project to work. Usually people respond to that pretty well. I mean, that doesn't mean it's easy, but like that's basically our recipe for how to try and, you know, bring people together.
So you mentioned that you're sort of kind of a consultant for these other teams, these other companies, and you try and help them. What's the interaction like between your team and all the other teams that you're working with? Do you embed somebody in a project? Do they come to you?
Normally. We don't even have room for Sarah is here with me, and she can verify that we don't even have room in the headquarters for all 24 people to sit down and work. On those occasional days when like the planets are in alignment and everybody's in town at the same time, it gets real crowded. So for the most part, most of our technical staff, most of the time, they're out at whatever agency they're working with, or they're out at the contractor offices they're working with. They're out in the field, as we say, somewhere. All of this work seems to happen within the Beltway plus 10 miles or something like that. So they're somewhere in Virginia or Maryland, but they're out at an agency or an office working like side by side with the teams that we went to work with. We try really hard to not and we select staff, we don't want people that are going to ride in with a really arrogant attitude and start, you know, throwing their weight around telling people what to do. That just, I don't think will be very successful in the long term, even if it like breaks, you know, even if it was a way to break down some like immediate obstacles. So we try to be really collaborative. We try to make clear that we are here, like I said, we are here to kind of give you permission to try something different and work through that with you. And we can give you advice, which people find very reassuring. There's a ton of people that have worked in the government for a long time who genuinely don't know what to expect at a non-government affiliated like software development job, that just literally don't know what it would be like to work at Facebook or Google. And they really respond pretty well when you say, like, look, there's this methodology. It's really, when I worked at Facebook, it was really useful to have this stand-up meeting 3 times a day, and we would just tell each other what we did. And it's okay. It won't take up a huge amount of time. We'll make sure that people stay on topic. Then, of course, maybe, as with every stand-up meeting I've ever been, maybe you actually achieve this or maybe you don't. But anyway, my point is that, like, there's a lot of practices that there's a lot of practices from the private sector that people are totally willing to try if you give them permission to do it. So that's kind of the mode of interaction that we like to have. We aren't there to take credit away from it. That's another important point. Like, we're not there to take credit for the work either. Of course, I say this having been on the cover of Time magazine for working on healthcare.gov, but you'll just have to take my word for it that wasn't the plan. That was an accident. We don't seek that out, and people appreciate that because they're not gonna respond super well if they perceive us as riding to town in order to like tell them what to do and then take all the credit for the project afterwards. That's not gonna work super well. So we don't encourage that. We do work pretty much in an embedded fashion with the groups that we're going to help.
So you come from Google, which is arguably one of the biggest companies on the face of the planet at this point as far as digital technology. And they gave you time off to go spend time at the government. How do we spread that sort of culture to other big companies so that service is seen as a plus?
I'll tell you, Google gave me time off is one interpretation of how that went down. It's
AWOL, perhaps?
It's well, it is also another way of telling that story would be that I went in and informed Google that I was going to be taking some time off, and that I was going to be going to do this other thing, and obviously, if they had said absolutely not, if you don't show up for work tomorrow, then you're fired, like, that would have been, I don't know, that would have been a hard decision. That wasn't their reaction. And I think if you're in a startup with, like, 6 people, yeah, we're probably not going to, it's not going to work real well for you to take, like, 3 months off. But generally, if you're in a kind of established team, you got a routine, you got other people that you can rely on that can backfill for you. If you're in a situation in which the world is not going to stop turning if you disappear for a few months, it's your large-ish company, and here's a hard dose of reality for a lot of us, it's in 100% of cases the world is not going to stop turning if you disappear from your current job for a few months. I would say you don't need any particular permission from us. You absolutely have the power to just ask. Ask your manager. You have an HR person assigned to you, whether you know it or not. Your division has an HR person who can answer questions about your leave policy. Ask them. If you don't get an answer that you like, ask a couple other people and see how it goes. We know specifically, we ourselves have personal experience with a lot of the larger tech companies out there. And if really push came to shove, if you have any personal connection to anybody affiliated with this effort, with the tech surge, with the ad hoc team, with the U.S. Digital Service, if you know anybody and can send them, if you run into any kind of difficulty, send them over any kind of email and say, look, here's what my team said when I asked for permission for time off. it's likely that we know somebody at your company that can help you. And we're happy to make those introductions.
The government's going to come to your door and say, can we borrow this person for a little while?
Well, if that helps, I can have some very high wattage celebrities make those phone calls, yes.
Excellent. So we're assuming at this point that the changes that were made to healthcare.gov and the work that everyone has done, the people higher up in the administration are sort of viewing this as, this is how we should do things now, and this is why you're putting out the playbook and these other tools for everyone. Have you had communications from people outside our government, like other governments perhaps, asking you, how are you turning this around? How do we do this ourselves? Are you consulting for anyone? Well, perhaps consulting is the wrong word, but are you in discussions with other companies or other countries even that are looking to do the same thing?
We have talked to a lot of governments in the United States, because don't forget that the entire federal government is only one part of the puzzle here. We have all the state, 50 state governments, and you know, not to mention the territories and commonwealths and everything else under the sun, plus all of the municipalities, cities, counties. So we have talked to a decent number of American governments. We talked to the UK has a government data service. They got to kind of the same place we're going. They got there before we did, and we talked to them some about like their lessons learned and so on and so forth. I wouldn't say that they're coming to us and asking to copy our model really so much, because it's more the other way around at this point. But we do talk to them a little bit. We don't have anything. We don't have any serious plans to get involved with other countries altogether. I figure the United States is a big enough problem for me to worry about right now this year. you know, if once we fixed all of those problems, if we've got time to kill, then sure, we'll look for world domination after that. But we do. Whoops, am I still there?
Yeah, you're still here.
Okay, the video disappeared on my end, so be it. We do put a decent amount of effort into open source, for example, because there's nothing that we're doing needs to be like particularly proprietary. We're happy for anybody anywhere in the world to you know, be able to take that work and build on it if they can. That is the extent of our attempt to work with other countries at this point.
Cool. And just to do a time check, I know that you had other things scheduled for this evening. Do you need to run?
I think I can do one more question. I got to be out of here by what for me is 8, which I guess will be 5.
So speaking about open software, open data, what sort of involvement does your group have with drawing people into the open government issue? I mean, there's a lot of bright people out there, and we can do a lot of things on our own with open data. Are you involved at all with making sure that we get more data out there for everyone to use?
Yes. We're super interested in that. In fact, the chief of staff on my staff, her name's Haley. She is the person who drove the open data executive order 2 or 3 years ago. She got that done, which just in case there's anybody in the audience out there who doesn't like subscribe to the RSS feed and read every single executive order every time it comes out, it's an order that says it's got a bunch of caveats to it, because it always has to, because it's like this legalese, but it basically says that anytime the government can release a data set that we own, like let's say for example the NOAA weather satellite data or something like that, I don't know, something that's not your personally identifiable information, it's not a privacy issue, it's not a national security issue, anything like that that can be made open will be made open. And even better, this is because smart people worked on it, it says will be made available in a non-proprietary machine-readable format. So this is already the instructions that the right, because you can perfectly well imagine how you could comply with the order to make it open and make it completely useless if you were so inclined. So we tried to make that not a possible outcome. That's already the instructions that the agencies operate under. Obviously, the implementation in some cases is better, in some places is better than in others. But we do work pretty hard on that. I'm not sure if it is in the current version of the playbook, but another thing that we try to do is factor big, complicated government services into APIs, we didn't do healthcare.gov this way. Maybe some future iteration of healthcare.gov will be done this way, but like all of those components that make healthcare.gov complicated, like it has to check your income verification with the IRS, it has to check your citizenship status with the agency that controls that data, all that stuff could be exposed in APIs. And the more of it that we did, the more that somebody would be able to come along and just make their own site that replicated the functionality. So we do care about that stuff. It is something that I hope you'll be able to really see a couple of years from now, a whole big long list of places where we have opened data sets that haven't been there before. In a lot of cases, there's data that's already open that just nobody knows about, which is another thing that we have to get better at. But if you are already part of the open data group, or if you're interested in this at all, hopefully you know that there's a decent amount of stuff out there if you know where to look. And if you don't know where to look, because like I said, our stuff is not super easy to find sometimes. Even with your favorite search engine Bing, it's not easy to find sometimes. So like if you know of some kind of government data that you think should be open that isn't, we'd be happy to take a look and see what the state of that is. It's assuming it doesn't turn into like a 6-month caving expedition, we can at least figure out the status of anything that people are interested in.
Great. Well, I'd like to thank you and your team and all the groups that you're working with for the work you've done already and all the work that you will continue to do in the future. It does make it a big impact, especially for those people who need it most. And thank you again for joining us to talk to us about this.
Thank you. There will, I don't actually know the details of this, but Amy, you talked to our you or somebody talked to our communication staff, and I'm sure we will get you some means of contacting us that you can put in the conference materials or in the program or whatever.
That would be fantastic. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks a lot, everybody. Thanks for having me. Sorry I couldn't be there in person.
Have a good night.